Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello, I'm Simon Long, the finance editor at The Economist, and this is Money Talks. Coming up this week, how big a headache is the hack of Equifax?
And if there's somebody else who can claim to be you, based on what they've taken from this credit reporting agency, then we have a big problem.
And in China, what are VIEs and why should we care?
So it's a kind of legal quick fix to the problem of foreign businesses owning sensitive assets in China.
But first, President Donald Trump has a rare opportunity to influence America's central bank. With the resignation of the vice chair of the U.S. Federal Reserve, Stanley Fischer, last week, the board there is severely depleted. Four out of seven board seats are now vacant, leaving the smallest number of governors in the Fed's history. Pressure is mounting for President Trump to name his candidates and to confirm whether or not he will replace the U.S. Fed chair, Janet Yellen. Henry Kerr, our U.S. economics editor, joins us from New York. Henry, before we talk about the choices for the succession, this is presumably quite an important week for the Fed. Just next week, there's a meeting of its rate-setting open markets committee.
Yes, exactly. So next week, it's widely expected that the Fed's going to announce the beginning of the reversal of QE. That is, during and after the financial crisis, it bought a lot of assets with newly created money, and it's going to start running down that balance sheet. So this is quite an important announcement, and it's happening at the same time as all these vacancies have appeared.
To back up a bit, Henry, QE, quantitative easing, was a policy introduced after the last financial crisis. How extensive has it been?
Well, the Fed's balance sheet is now about $4.5 trillion. Before the financial crisis, it was less than a trillion dollars. So they've bought a lot of assets. They're sitting on about $2.5 trillion of treasury bonds and almost $2 trillion of mortgage-backed securities. So it really has been a substantial intervention in financial markets that they're now looking to unwind. They said for a long time that they would unwind it once interest rate rises were well underway, and now with the interest rate rises we've had to date, they think that time has come. So they're going to set the reversal of QE on autopilot.
Presumably the risk with this is that they distort or disrupt the market quite substantially by these large amounts of bond sales that they're going to have to undertake.
Well, there's a good debate on this, really. Most people seem to think that the reversal of QE will have less of an impact than QE did in the first place, because when the Feds first started acquiring assets, financial markets were pretty seized up. And as a result of this kind of strange behaviour, the Fed coming in and buying lots of assets had a big effect. Now financial markets are functioning much more smoothly, so people seem to think it will be less effective on the way out than the way in. The other thing to bear in mind is that they have meticulously signalled that this is going to happen, and as a result, quite a lot of the effect has been baked in. That said, the Fed's position, particularly in the market for mortgage-backed securities, is a substantial fraction of the overall size of the market. And so there are sceptics who say, I don't think all the effect has been baked in and that we will still see some price moves as the Fed gets out of this market. But these price moves are going to have to happen over a long period of time, because on the plans that the Fed has kind of penciled in without pulling the trigger on yet, it's going to take a long time to unwind these positions fully.
Okay, let's turn to the question of the Fed's leadership. When we were talking just a few weeks ago, your picks, as you like, as the favourite was for Gary Cohn to be named as the new Fed chair, and failing that Janet Yellen would be asked to stay on. Is it fair to say that Mr. Cohn is now a less likely candidate?
Yes, I think that is fair. So there was quite a significant day in the Fed race after we spoke last time, when Gary Cohn gave this interview to the Financial Times in which he was critical of President Trump's response to the white supremacist march in Charlottesville. And on the same day, Janet Yellen was gave a kind of resolute defence of the post-crisis increase in financial regulations that Donald Trump has said he wanted to unwind. So from those two events, people have been saying that the chances of both Janet Yellen and Gary Cohn have fallen. I think Cohn's have fallen more than Yellen's. The president is reportedly not happy with him at all. And it's notable that in his remarks on tax reform, the president hasn't really referred to Gary Cohn while continuing to refer to other advisers, despite the fact that Gary Cohn's meant to be leading the tax reform effort. And so if that's a signal of displeasure, then it's hard to believe that he's about to appoint Cohn Fed chair.
So who's heading the race now?
Well, I probably personally put Janet Yellen still as the favourite, but there are other names on the table. I think last time we discussed Kevin Warsh, he's in a much stronger position than he was. This is a Republican policymaker who was on the Fed board during the financial crisis and was actually a very close to Ben Bernanke during the financial crisis. He's also been more hawkish in his recent comments, which I think might be a concern for financial markets were he appointed. But he's the most obvious beneficiary of the stock of both Cohn and Yellen falling at the same time, as they seemed to a few weeks ago.
And what impact does Mr. Fisher's resignation, from personal reasons, we understand, what impact does that have?
Well, it's just served to underline, really, the extent to which the president's going to be able to remake the Fed, should he wish. I mean, Stanley Fisher's term was due to expire next year anyway, just as Janet Yellen's is. So Donald Trump was always going to be able to appoint a new vice chair to the Fed. That said, what was unclear is whether Stanley Fisher was going to stay on the committee after he gave up the vice chair, as he was entitled to do. And obviously that uncertainty has now been lifted. It's clear that he will be leaving the Fed altogether. And so that just ramps up the extent to which the president is definitely going to be able to influence the makeup of the Fed. Incidentally, that question about whether or not he would stay on as a governor, having left the vice chair, that still applies to Janet Yellen. If Janet Yellen's not reappointed, she could still choose to stay on the committee. It's unlikely, but not unprecedented.
Henry Kerr, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, Equifax, the credit scoring company, has announced that it was hacked in July. 143 million American consumers had their data compromised. This is the worst security breach in the industry's history and could have a significant impact on those affected by it. The economist Eric Monkman has been looking into this and joins me in the studio now. Eric, let's start by sort of defining terms. What exactly is a credit bureau and how important is it in the American financial system?
Well, credit reporting companies or credit bureau are very important in the American financial system because they keep track of whether consumers have paid their bills in the past. So they keep track of money that's been borrowed, money that's been paid back. Have they paid it back on time? Have they paid it back at all? And as you can imagine, this requires them to keep a very large database of personal identifying information so they can make sure, which is very important, that the report is on the right person, that they're not lending to a different Eric Monkman or a different Simon Long who's asking for a loan.
And how much of that database has been compromised? How much is out there?
Reports say that up to 143 million people had their data compromised by a hacking incident at Equifax. Now, for these people, this would be information such as their date of birth, their name, their address, and the Social Security number, which is a very important piece of personal identifying information in the United States. Now, for about 200,000, there's also information about their credit history that may have been compromised. And for another approximately 200,000, there's information about previous credit disputes that they have been into, which would also include other personal identifying information. So lots of data.
So taking out that first big chunk of data, I mean, presumably the big risk is that with that information, a hacker or somebody the hacker sold the information to could go online and steal this person's identity, basically, and apply for a loan as somebody else.
That's what we're worried about. You know, the thing about credit reporting agencies, you know, we've seen this a bit this in the past few weeks of organizations that can't do what they claim to do. We saw that with Bell Pottinger. You know, we have a reputation management firm that can't manage its own reputation. Here we have a credit reporting agency that's one job is to make sure that when you apply for credit, the lender is getting accurate information about you. And if there's somebody else who has your personal information and can provide it and claim to be you based on what they've taken from this credit reporting agency, then we have a big problem.
Indeed, the comparison you make is quite a drastic one, if you like. I mean, Bell Pottinger, at least the UK arm of it, seems quite likely to go out of business. I think Equifax saw its share price drop after this was announced by some 20%. This is a business in serious trouble.
Very big trouble. We're probably going to see congressional investigations. The Attorney General of New York is having a look into this issue. It's going to be a big deal.
And what is it doing to counter the effects?
It's had a bit of a strange response. It's waited for about a month before announcing that this has happened. And now it's telling consumers to go onto its website and they can enroll in a service that will supposedly protect their identity, that is a proprietary service from Equifax that offers them insurance of up to $1 million US if their identity is stolen and they incur expenses, as well as monitoring if their personal information is used in a suspicious manner. And that's what we've heard so far. And consumers have been having trouble getting what they need, I think, from this website. Certainly, it's been a challenge for people.
Thank you, Eric Monkman. Do you trust the keepers of information anymore? Please contact us via Twitter at Economist Radio or email us at radio@economist.com. And finally, companies' legal structures are generally mind-numbing, but occasionally it is worth pinching yourself and paying attention. Take variable interest entities, or VIEs, a kind of corporate architecture used mainly by China's tech firms, including its two superstars, Alibaba and Tencent. Largely unnoticed, VIEs have become incredibly important. Investors outside of China have about $1 trillion at stake in firms that use them. Patrick Fowles, Schumpeter columnist, can explain all. Hello, Patrick.
Hello, Simon.
To start with, a very basic question. What on earth are VIEs, the latest thing we've never heard of that we should be worried about?
Well, to understand the origins of VIEs, you have to go slightly back in time. A lot of Chinese companies wanted to list their shares on big global stock markets, mainly New York and Hong Kong. So they set up holding companies abroad. But by doing that, they became foreign entities in the eyes of China, which then disqualified them from owning sensitive assets in China. So VIEs were the answer to that. And essentially, the key sensitive assets, things like licenses and copyrights, are put into special legal entities which are owned by the managers. Those are the VIEs. They then write contracts with the companies. And as, if you believe the companies, those contracts give the companies the effective right of control and effective ownership of the assets, even though they don't have the legal title. So it's a kind of legal quick fix to the problem of foreign businesses owning sensitive assets in China.
And is it something that the Chinese authorities have explicitly approved, or is it out there in some sort of grey area?
It's clear that they are tolerated at the moment, but it's also clear there's not really any body of case law that gives them a solid foundation. And in fact, in 2015, the Ministry of Commerce published a draft reform which appeared to make life very difficult for some VIEs, although that now seems to have been put on ice. But in essence, it's a very ambiguous legal position they're in.
And is there pressure to change these arrangements?
Well, the cynics, again, would argue the companies quite like it because it gives the managers power over these sensitive assets. And maybe the government does too, because it keeps the internet tycoons who control these very powerful companies, it keeps them on a sort of slightly nervous footing. And maybe it's helpful for the government to get those tycoons to toe the line politically. In the long run, however, it does seem like one of those things that has to be reformed. And although there are a variety of other legal quick fixes that might be experimented, in the end, probably the answer is for China to relax its controls on foreign ownership and also relax its restrictions on Chinese people investing overseas. And we'll see if that happens eventually.
Patrick Fowles, thank you. That's all for this episode of Money Talks. Don't forget to rate us on iTunes. To read more about all the stories, check out the forthcoming issue of The Economist or visit our website at economist.com. I'm Simon Long. Thanks for joining us. In London, this is The Economist.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.